a number of significant information to kind of let us know what was going on. They tell us that, quote, the first capacity building grant allowed us to hire our first paid employees in 2021. Mm-hmm. They spent the year building up the governance and financial management, human resources, volunteer management, marketing and branding. They had an extension then in 2022, which they used to do research on how better to serve the people of their area. Mm-hmm. And it led to work, which eventually, led to research that led to their creating the monthly Brick House Group for Black, Indigenous and racialized folks. They also had funds for training. They were able to attend a capacity building board boot camp. So this round of funding, the one that I was specifically asking about, this enabled them to work with the fundraising lab, where they've created a new case of support. For those outside of the nonprofit sector, it's essentially a case of support is the reasons why you should donate to them. Mm-hmm. Like, what is it that this charity does that without them would lead to whatever consequence?
Yes. Is your return on investment?
What is the social good generated by your donation? And it's not easy to create a case of support, and a lot of charities don't have them. So this is great news that they've worked with the fundraising lab to do that. They updated their donor database. They had a two-day training on two-spirit knowledge and decolonization from the university. They sent more people to the board boot camp and modern board courses, and they've done video training sessions and so on and so forth. They also get provincial and municipal fundraising, it's had a significant impact on their capacity building. But in the way, what really has stood out to me from both Spectrum and Quadrangle is that when you look at what that grant is supposed to do, take an organization, give it money so that it can tool up or skill up or staff up to then be able to deliver services more effectively, more efficiently, stand on its own 2 feet. You know, that was the point of the grant.
Organizations that are new and struggling or have high turnover often have issues with governance and figuring out how do you get things to work? And Robert's Rules of Order is just like a very minor example of that. But we have both sat in on organizations that clearly needed help from the outside.
Yeah. Where a Canada board boot camp would have been extremely beneficial.
Yes. Especially if it's the kind of boot camp where people yell at you if you get it wrong.
Yes. You have to do chin-ups if you don't know what a point of order or point of information is.
Oh, that would have been beautiful.
We ask them, and I'm quoting here one of our own questions.
Yeah.
What do you predict would be the impact on Spectrum if there was no federal funding available?
Yes.
And the executive director told us here, quote, had we not had these federal capacity building dollars, we would still be a small, volunteer-run organization that could not make the kind of positive impact that we are currently making for the 2S LGBTQI plus people in the Waterloo region. Mm. And I think that sums it up.
Yeah, yeah.
That really does sort of cover what we're looking at.
But they wouldn't shutter their doors. They would just fall back on being volunteer, which would limit them. But yeah, they wouldn't shutter their doors.
Exactly. Now, we also did reach out to Fierté Canada Pride.
Right.
Now, Fierté Canada Pride is an association of pride organizations in Canada. They have received significant funding. Now, we thought that pearls were being clutched for the $500,000 to CCGSD. Well, Fierté Canada Pride has received from the Capacity Fund $1.5 million. In addition, they had a slightly different program where they received an additional $365,000. Now, I should clarify, they have been awarded these grants. Mm-hmm. As we found out with CCGSD, they may not have physically received all of the money.
Okay.
But we did want to get a better understanding of very similar questions. How reliant are you on federal funding?
Mm-hmm.
What measures have you rolled out with the funding? And would you be financially stable without it? And the response that we had from Fierté Canada Pride really kind of details a lot of what they do. We spoke with the Director of Operations and Sustainability, Bryce Field. What Bryce was able to say is that they focus a lot on development. I'll quote them here so that we're not misinterpreting. Quote, our work, guided by the capacity building grant from WAGE, focused on strengthening governance, improving financial management, and developing resources that benefit both FCP and our member organizations. Key activities include expanding funding resources, enhancing financial transparency, and building strategic collaborations. It goes on. Our flagship project, also supported by federal funding, is the Community Safety Fund, now in the second of a three-year initiative. With an annual budget of $1.5 million, this fund allocates $1.35 million in grants to 2S LGBTQIA plus organizations across Canada to address rising hate and safety concerns. These grants enable organizations to invest in safety training, protective equipment, secure infrastructure, public awareness campaigns, and other essential measures. The Community Safety Fund responds to a growing need for resources in regions where the 2S LGBTQIA plus communities experience increased risks and harassment. By distributing these funds, Fierté Canada Pride empowers local groups to proactively support their members' well-being, reinforce resilience across Canada's 2S LGBTQIA plus network. This initiative reflects Fierté Canada Pride's commitment to safety and support, particularly in underserved and vulnerable communities. And Bryce finishes the email with this. I hope this answers your questions. It's a challenging time for nonprofits in Canada, with uncertain funding and few options that truly support core operations rather than just new projects. Unfortunately, we may see other organizations facing financial situations similar to CCGSD, but I'm confident Fierté Canada Pride won't be one of them.
Well, when you have sustainability in your job title,
You should better hope it does.
Yeah,
but I will say this: that what Bryce at Fierté Canada Pride has hit the nail on the head on.
Yeah.
Is that, for example, I looked at the annual giving report from Imagine Canada. I think it was Imagine Canada. I'll double check. Sorry, Canada Helps.
Right.
They run a large donation platform. They work with a lot of charities. And they've noted in their 2024 giving report that for the 11th year running, Canadians are making less charitable donations.
Yes.
The last tax data available shows a decline of 23% from 2010 to 2021. Their own survey and data with charities shows this continued ongoing decline as well. We looked at Canadian charity law, and they note that for the year in which the data is most recently available, 2023, the government provided over $204 billion in support for charities, compared to $18 billion in donation receipts.
Right.
There is definitely a very relevant concern that Canadians just are not donating to charities anywhere near the capacity that they were before.
Yeah.
In the in Carleton, they have a department that focuses on charities, and Don McRae there noted that there were 1,471 new charities this year. However, there were 2,016 charities closed. So at the start of 2024, there were 645 less. Sorry, 645 fewer charities.
Yes,
operating in Canada. More foundations, but less charities.
That was a correct edit, by the way.
Thank you. I appreciate I appreciate that.
Although you did say less donations earlier instead of fewer donations.
Well, also less. Each total donation value. Was left.
Yeah. I've read data about that, that if you were to, and going across generations as well, so if you look at a 25-year-old now, they're donating less than a 25-year-old did 20, 40, 60 years ago. Mm-hmm. And you could say, well, you know, the financial difficulties. Well, they also had financial difficulties in the 80s. There was a depression in the early 70s. Like, you know, even when you compare it against other periods of financial hardship in Canadian history, it's even when you account for that, it's still lower.
Yeah. So let's put it another way. As a portion of income.
Yeah.
You know, or as a, maybe not even just income, as a portion of your expenses.
Yeah.
The amount of money going out as a percentage compared to previous generations. Like, even when you start looking at comparing oranges to oranges.
Yeah.
Because it is so incredibly difficult. Food and cost of living pricing is so high.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And let's not forget the fact that...
But the gas crisis also created a cost of living crisis back in the 70s. So, I mean, like, it's analogous. I'm not going to say it's the same, but it's analogous. And even though, like, wages weren't as suppressed as they are kind of getting now, but the total expenses of living was quite high because of the gas crisis. So, I mean, even when, yeah, like, as you say, comparing oranges to oranges, when you start looking at equivalents, it still shakes out that people are just donating less than they used to.
Exactly. Well, it puts queer organizations in a tricky spot.
Yeah.
I do appreciate that when we've reached out to these queer organizations that are heavily funded by the federal government to find out, is there a sustainability plan? Yeah. There is. Are there grants working towards the outlined objectives? From what we can tell, they are. And, you know, it seems to be that the organizations that we spoke to, with the exception of CCGSD, has been forthcoming and forthright in terms of their answers to us.
So I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. As a former fundraiser and ED for organizations, I feel like, to a degree, there's just been a change in the modality of donations, in the sense that even though a 30-year-old is less likely to just give $50 to a charity or a local radio station, for example, they're much less likely to do that. But if you're to sell, for example, a $2 canvas bag with branding on it for $60, they would be willing to do that. It's the idea of, like, knowingly overpaying for something that is part of a charity run versus just handing out money. That there seems to be that change in modality, and you're seeing a little bit more of that now. I don't know if that's covering the bases, but, like, does that seem to be, like, things have just been changing?
Well, what I can speak to is fundraising that happens at radio stations.
Yeah.
So everywhere we are, unless you're listening to our podcast, they do funding drives or fundraising in some format. We are syndicated or non-profit and charity-run radio stations.
And a bunch of program directors across Canada have put down their pens and they're listening to us.
they're like, okay, what is he going to say? Is he going to let the cat out of the bag? But what I can tell you is this, is that when people value a service and you can make the argument that the service we deliver is of value and without us, you would be missing something significant. For example, our own show.
Yeah.
We are, in many markets across Canada, we are the only radio program or entertainment program out there that covers current affairs in the 2S LGBTQ community. We're one of the only media that has picked up this bankruptcy story from CCGSD, for example. And without us, is the world a better place without it? Who knows? But I feel that without us, there would be a lot more shadows, a lot more dark, and a lot more that we just wouldn't know. The accountability would be less easy to pursue. And also, for young queer folks in these communities, this is of interest. And even for those of us who are listening to us right now, who don't identify as 2S, LGBTQI+, blah, 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 alphabet soup, knowing that there are people in our community who is holding our own community accountable is important for friends, for family members who maybe are 2S LGBTQ identified.
Yeah.
You know, like, we are a mosaic of Canadians.
Okay, really my question, though, was that, do you think it's just that the nature of charitability has changed and there's just certain organizations that have failed to modernize? So, for example, I balk at the idea of spending $20 to go to see a movie in the theater. It's just, that is not, that entertainment versus dollar price value doesn't check out for me. But a few years ago, and I was struggling at the time, I was an impoverished student, but I still spent $180 to go to a one-night party. And it was a good party. And really, the ticket price should have been $25, but all that extra cash went to HIV research. Mm-hmm. So when I looked at it, it was like the ticket price, even though I would never, ever go to a $180 party, knowing that the extra went to charity, it felt okay to me. And I think that changed.
I understand where you're thinking, and what motivates someone to give is, broadly speaking, generational. So, for example, older generations, we're talking 45 and up. So we're talking Gen X, definitely boomers,
yeah,
who are in the 60s and 70s. For them, the biggest motivation is the social good.
Yeah.
That in order for us to live in a nicer, kinder, happier, mm-hmm, more local community, it is important that I support that because it is something that I feel is important.
Mm-hmm.
And that social good motivated giving has a lot of roots in religion. Christian organizations have kind of the bedrock with that. But
charitability
also
is one of the bedrocks of,
of the big three monotheistic religions.
Yeah.
So there's a huge baseline in those generations. Now, when you look at millennials, there has always been a sort of scarcity mindset with millennials, that the idea of a tithe or giving just because has not really permeated this culture. Millennials are looking more for that value exchange.
But millennials were also the ones who popularized spending $40 on a $1 rubber bracelet.
Yeah, and that's the value exchange I was talking about. Sometimes you can motivate a donation with a unique item or what have you. The idea of giving just because doesn't sit as well with millennials. They want to know why.
Yeah.
And what happens?
I want to know the overhead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you're also just nosy.
Yeah.
But then when you're looking at Gen Z,
it is even
more difficult to kind of suss out those younger generations.
Yeah.
These are people who are entering the workforce. They have incomes now.
Yeah, yeah.
Incomes where they can choose to donate. And I think what all charities and nonprofits have to do is tailor their messaging to Canadians in their own communities and say, look, if you like what we do, imagine the world without us.
Yeah.
But also, this is, like, it's important. Like, we cannot sustain without your support. Now, the idea of tchotchkes and $100 tickets and disposable items doesn't fly with Gen Z as much.
Okay.
They're not as keen on a tote bag that costs $2 that you're charging $100 for, because it, you know, it touches on that disposable consumer environment. They're far more environmentally conscious.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And certainly, like, the way
I didn't choose canvas bag as an example for nothing.
Yeah, but every generation is the subject of the cultural context of their time.
Mm-hmm.
And that impacts us, broadly speaking, on how we how we do. And I think that there's a sense of paralysis. Like, there are so many challenges. The unbelievable human toll happening in Middle East and in the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
The impending climate disaster.
Yeah.
You know, every year there are things in our own neighborhoods. We all can walk to the middle of town and see homelessness.
Yeah.
So how do you pass through that and find the one thing where your dollar is important and can make a difference?
And there's also, over the past few years, there have been multiple major scandals where quote-unquote charitable organizations accept millions of dollars in donations. They do nothing with it, but then they buy mansions. You know, like, there has been a lot of corruption scandals lately with regards to charitable organizations.
Not a huge amount, but you're referring to, like, the charitable industrial complex.
Yeah.
So the idea of mega giant charities where they have a machinery of bureaucracy that is hard to move. But
and just getting exposed for having, like, an 80% overhead and doing very little to actually do the mission that they say they're doing. And in some cases, no observable impact on anything whatsoever. And there have been a lot of scandals like that over the past 10 years. So I can imagine people getting a little bit paralyzed with that. I mean, that's why I keep falling back on food banks as being, like, the perfect place to donate. Tiny overhead.
You should be a spokesperson.
Massive social impact.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, there's no corruption scandals with that. It's,
well, I mean,
not that I've heard.
It's funny because even in the last 2 weeks, I've seen reports of two trans organizations in the States where executives walked away with hundreds of thousands in stolen dollars. It happens all over the country and all over the sectors. Yeah. But what I'm thinking about is, how do we motivate people to donate? How do we get them to care? Mm-hmm. When I'm talking to radio stations about how to fundraise, so the station you're listening to this on right now, they have to compete for you to give them that dollar. They're competing with kittens, cancer, and kids, and then also cornflakes. Yeah. Like, you're competing against, everybody loves kittens and animals, and it's something that people hold dear.
Yeah.
Everyone has someone in their family who has been impacted by cancer. Mm-hmm. Everybody can be motivated to donate to the local children's hospital and children's charities. Mm-hmm. And everyone is struggling to make ends meet mm-hmm. and buy the name brand cornflakes or not have breakfast that day.
Yeah.
So how do you get that person with their $1 they're ready to donate mm-hmm. to choose you over kittens, cancer, kids, and cornflakes?
Yeah.
Because it's a really tough choice. It's an incredibly competitive market. And for queer organizations that are so niche, that serve communities that are isolated, underrepresented, they may be disconnected from families, they're systematically more likely to have health issues, systematically more likely to have lower employment or less pay.
And having worked within a lot of these LGBT organizations, we know that people are more than happy to volunteer their time. Getting people to volunteer their time is quite, I'm not going to say easy, but less difficult for a lot of these organizations, but that's not what keeps the lights on. They do need a dollar here and there to help keep the lights on. But in terms of, like, I don't know, the number of times I've seen queer organizations that just do a full rebranding top to bottom, and it turns out there's a graphic designer who just donated their time. Mm-hmm. So that would have been, like, there's a value trade of like 20 grand in some cases to do a rebranding of that scale, completely volunteered.
One thing I will, because we will jump to a song because we have some international news that I'm determined we don't miss this week. One thing I will say is the best way for charities and organizations to speak effectively to each of these generations mm-hmm. is to have the argument for why that's important to be coming from that generation.
Yeah.
If you're a radio station trying to convince Gen Z why what you do is important, mm-hmm. have Gen Z tell you. Have Gen Z be the forefront. So you're speaking a common language. Your cultural references are the same and relevant.
Yeah. And talk to several people. Don't just ask your cousin and roll.
Don't just ask the one intern.
Because there's been a lot of times you're like, yeah, we interviewed people, and you look at the interviews, like, they interviewed five people who already agree with you in the first place.
Exactly.
Look for people who are difficult, because the people who are difficult, they're difficult because they disagree with you, and them disagreeing with you is what makes them a valuable resource.
Exactly. Well, actually, I think we don't have time for another music break. We have moved a little bit longer than I thought, but I do want to mention some of the international news. Another high court in Japan has ruled the same-sex marriage ban in Japan as unconstitutional. The High Court of Tokyo this time mm-hmm. ruling against it. They also had a study in Australia. 1 in 10 Australian teens identify as queer in some shape, form, or substance. Mm-hmm. Was there any international news that you also have don't want us to miss?
I don't. Yes, but it's kind of a bigger story.
Yeah, we'll cover that one next time. But I do want to make sure that I mention that in Ireland they passed a hate crime bill. I'm also looking into the disappearance of the bisexual rugby player Levi Davis, English rugby player who went missing outside of Ibiza in Spain. Mm. A local newspaper did some coverage of it and found that there were definitely gaps in the investigation. So we're keeping an eye on that as well. But otherwise, there are more news that we're keeping an eye on, including a nightclub owner who was killed in Mexico, to see how these things all emerge. I wanted to play Sophie Ellis-Bextor's new track, I Can't Dance, but We are a Canadian show and we do have to promote Canadian content. So this is Crawl by the fantastically talented Julia Dales out of Ottawa. We've played Julia Dales on a number of occasions. This is Crawl. I've been Luke Smith.
And I've been Sebastian. And thank you for listening.